concept.
Which is very important. Very important.
I think the our major advances are really in the realm of understanding what causes pulp disease. And if we understand what causes pulp disease, we can then use preventative measures. Preventative dentistry or preventative medicine is the cheapest and most efficient way of really eliminating disease. You don't even give it a chance. And the only way that you can get objectives or methods for prevention is to understand the etiology. And as far as the endodontic problems are concerned, I think that it has to stem in the schools, teaching them pulp biology, making them recognize that what they do to the dentine, how they cut the tooth, will influence the pulp, will produce a pulp reaction. So if we teach them how to cool the tooth properly, or how to cut the tooth properly, to prevent any complications of pulp necrosis, you're going to have less endodontics being done. As a matter of fact, more endodontics is done today from dentistogenic procedures, what the dentist does to the tooth, rather than from caries. The offices, your offices are loaded not because of dental caries. They are caused primarily because of the extensive cutting that is done for mouth reconstruction, crown preparations. That's where the problem is. So what we have to do is to teach pulp biology to the undergrad student, and also to the clinician or to the instructor that's teaching them. Because they go in and hear a lecture of what they shouldn't do, and then they go on the floor and the instructor tells them, do it this way, and it's contrary to what they're thinking. So this, I think, the future of preventative endodontics lies in the understanding of pulp physiology and what the dentist does to the pulp. The other area as far as the future of endodontics is concerned is, I've already mentioned it, in the field of microcirculatory or circulatory physiology and neurophysiology of the pulp, based on the studies of Edwall and Olgaert and Kim and Van Hassel. These are the people that, with their findings and so forth, will give us a better understanding of what's going on. And also understanding more the periapical pathophysiology as to what is actually going on periapically, so we don't, when we discuss these things, it's not always in terms of infection. It may not be infection at all. It may be an immunologic reaction, you see. Or it may be a chemical irritation. It may be allergic phenomena, stuff like that. So we need, for example, a more biomedical understanding of what's going on as far as the pulp is concerned. Also, as far as the interrelationship of pulp and periodontal disease is a very important consideration, because we know the existence of the lateral canals, and they're exposed, and therefore they will affect the pulp. And if you have periodontal disease and you have a necrotic pulp, you're certainly not going to be able to get a healing of the periodontal lesion. So we have to have that understanding. Now, as far as the future of endodontics is concerned in its relationship to society, I think what we have to consider is that we have to serve a greater number of people to give them endodontic procedures and periodontic procedures to be able to save their own teeth. And I feel that the specialization of endodontics and the specialization of periodontics with the advent of the better teaching in the schools of endodontics and periodontics, where the generalist is going to be able to do most of this work, there will be less need of the endodontist and the periodontist. And we can overcome that by combining the two programs, perio and endo, together. Have one specialty so that you get a more sophisticated individual. And he doesn't have, for instance, you have to do endodontics and something wrong with the gum because you have to put the rubber dam on or it goes under the gum and so forth. You're not going to be able to do it properly because you need some periodontal treatment first. So you send it to a periodontist, the patient's subjected to the expense, and then he comes back to you, it's a double expense. But more important than that, from an economic point of view, I'm thinking, is this. You have to train a periodontist in, let's assume, 2 years, and it costs so much money. And you have to have an endodontist and train him for 2 years, and it costs so much money. If you combine the two and it's 4 years then. See, two people, 4 years. It would be cheaper if you had one person being trained for 3 years and have both together. Plus the fact that we should develop periodontal personnel that will be able to do many of the things that the endodontist has to do, like putting the rubber dam on. Of course, the girl takes the extra, putting the rubber dam on, giving infiltration anesthesia, everything they'll be ready for you. You prepare the, as a matter of fact, they can fill the canals once you start it. They can finish filling the canals. Equally as good as any of the others. So by having the paradental personnel do the work, it would be cheaper for the patient. And as far as remuneration to the endodontist, periodontist is concerned, he would be able to handle more patients because he depends on the periodontal personnel to do most of the work. He doesn't have to do it all. You know, I'll tell you this, I look upon the dentist as a physician who bothers giving an enema. Now, no physician gives an enema. He has a nurse give it. And I think that it's about time the dentist started to get their periodontal personnel to give the enemas, like putting on the rubber dam, taking off the rubber dam, doing all these, putting in the temporary fillings and so forth and so on. So I don't think that there is a threat as far as the economy is concerned. I think that he would be better off in the future. And you have to think in terms of society. You can't think in terms of what's good for the endodontist only or what's good for the periodontist. You have to think in terms of the total society. And as time goes on, you know right well now, with the advent of the third-party payments and all these unions developing these things and so forth, they're going to look for easier ways and cheaper ways of doing it. And you don't have to sacrifice quality. Another thing is this. I think that the dual specialties, particularly in periodontics and endodontics, is very important because in the big metropolitan areas, you can avail yourself of an endodontist and a periodontist. But suppose you go into a town, there are 20,000 or 15,000 people. There's an endodontist, but there's no periodontist. Or there's a periodontist and no endodontist. What are you going to do? So I feel that if you train those kind of people, and we've already started it, you know, this idea is my own idea, which I introduced at Penn. It's already been accepted. We have those kind of joint programs of a perio-endo program, 3-year program. And right now, the ADA is beginning to accept it. So this is these are some of my thoughts on the endodontics as I saw it, as I then endodontics as I've practiced under the old mechanistic regime, and endodontics as I changed in my own way. I don't try to force it on anybody else, examine it, see how it fits in with your scheme of thinking. If you like it, accept it. If you don't like it, don't accept it. I don't think it's anything earth-shattering. I think that one has to evaluate the facts as they are and apply it in the society in which we are living in. Not the way it used to be. It's not the same. And dentistry will not be in 1990 or in the year 2000 what it is today. And if the endodontists and the periodontists, the leaders, don't have the vision to make the changes, then they'll be lost. The specialties will be wiped out. There won't be any need for it. But if you can realize that and consolidate, for example, as the suggestion I'm making of combining the various specialties, it's utterly ridiculous to have the number of specialties in dentistry that exist today is absolutely ridiculous in the field, I mean, in which we are working. You take, for instance, an ophthalmologist. That's a specialty. You don't have all these different ones. Of course, you know, you can say, well, you have an optometrist, you have an optician, and so, all right, so you have a lab technician. That's what it amounts to.
We don't have a retinologist, we don't have a...
That's right, exactly. Or a guy that just treats the cornea and so forth. You have an ophthalmologist, mm-hmm. You see. And so the same thing holds true as far as dentistry is really a specialty of medicine. But within that, my goodness, I mean, the framework of which... you take, for example, the oral surgeon today, the dental oral surgeon today, if it wasn't for removing impacted teeth, he wouldn't do anything. And that's why whenever they see an impacted tooth right away, or a tooth that hasn't erupted, extract. Absolutely no reason in the world why to do it.
But they have nothing better.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, do you have anything else that you might have missed that you'd like to go through, Dr. Bender?
I don't know.
I think we've covered the original outline pretty closely. I'm not certain in your personal life if you have anything.
Well, actually, what I said, I mean, I marked it down because I gave it a little thought. I mean, the future... student-teacher relationships, which I discussed, and then of course you can read that thing that I had as far as I think that the training in the a hospital training program offers. I mean, in a good medical center, offers the dentist a tremendous experience, a very, very broadening point of view, number one. He also tends to develop a better sense of social consciousness in his responsibility to the patient, because I owe him my contention is that the most important individual in the hospital or the most important individual in your office is the patient,
right.
Not you, not the nurse or anybody else, you see. And most of them think in terms of themselves or somebody else. And the same thing holds true in the school. The most important individual is the student. Not the instructor, not the dean, not the head of the department. Because if you didn't have any students, you wouldn't have any school. And the way their philosophy is, if they would follow that philosophy, you see, they would get better teaching. Because the student is there to learn, just the same as the patient is in your office to get relief. The student is the most important individual in the school. And this is where the conflict in teaching comes in when you have patients in the hospital and patients in the school. The procedure is modified in the school because it can only be done within the framework of the capability of the student. In the hospital, they have to give them the finished product. And that's why it's important. However, it would be very, very difficult to try to assign, for instance, every dental student to go for a dental internship. Uh-huh. We don't have enough beds for that. Because you take, for example, in our hospital, we have five general dentists for a 1,000-bed hospital. Of course, we have 6 orthodontists and we have 4 endodontists. But nevertheless, let's assume, for instance, here that with graduate and undergraduate training, you got 10, 15 interns for a 1,000-bed hospital. Whereas for a 1,000-bed hospital, the medical residents and the specialties and so forth are about 75 or 100 or more, you see. So we can't accommodate. But wherever possible, it should be accommodated. And I think that some of the schools, I know that Temple does, and the University of Pennsylvania, they send their students there to work for a couple of weeks and so forth to get a better understanding. Also, as far as endodontic training is concerned, in the hospital, they have a greater chance of seeing more cases, more complicated cases, and more trauma cases, and more emergency cases than you would in a school. Because when a patient is in an automobile accident, they don't go to dental school, they go to the hospital. Or the patient's got a toothache 2 o'clock in the morning, they go to the hospital, they don't go to school. So he has a wonderful opportunity there, you know, to learn. These are certain areas, I mean, where making themselves available of that gives them the opportunity to broaden themselves and better themselves.
I want to thank you very, very much, Dr. Benner.
Not at all.
I'm certain that the keenness of your insights and your realism, you know,
all right,
will be...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Will be treasured.
All right. I'd like to...
I'm gonna hook you, though.
What's up?
Here we go, back. Okay. I'll go on now. Okay. Would you care to comment on, historically, the evolution of the educational aspect of the AAE meanings?
Yeah, well, this goes back to, I think, our first meeting formation was, I believe, in 1942 or 43, thereabouts. I'm not exact on the date. And I remember one of the first, this was a meeting whereby we decided to have root canal therapist is what we were called, or we're going to call ourselves. one of the considerations. The term endodontist came out a little later, but I remember in the first meeting, there was a demonstration by Ralph Summers, who was advocating the use of the rubber dam, and he felt that there was no reason why the rubber dam shouldn't be used, because it could only take 10 seconds to put it on. And he had one of us sit down, and he put the rubber dam on another dentist, and we timed him, you know, it took 8 seconds. So that was a big deal. And then most of the presentations that we had were this before and after. You see this big area? Now it disappeared. This was the kind of x-ray year after year, x-ray showing before and after, because they used this therapy or they used this drug, and it was because of this drug and not because of the other drug. And they never showed anything of statistical significance. All they showed were the cases that healed. The cases that didn't heal, they must have buried them under the carpet or something. Well, we got tired of this one time, and we said, look, we see these great successes and so forth, and this is one of the suggestions that I made. Why don't we have a presentation on failures? We can learn more from failures than we can from these successes. Everybody does the same thing. Why do we have failures? So we decided, well, let's get the top brass, namely Ralph Summers, Ostrander, Grossman, and Healy. This was the big top brass in those particular days. And let's see what they show. I mean, what they can show. So I remember going over to one of the men, and I said, how about it? In the next year, could you be on the program, you know, for failures? He says, who's got failures? And he was very serious. And we finally had this on failures. Well, there were misdiagnoses. They were complete, you know, had nothing to do with the problem whatsoever. I thought that what they would do is say, just like you and I have the present experience, we do everything that you're supposed to do, and God darn it, the case doesn't heal. Where are those cases? And so they never addressed themselves to it. And finally, we got sick and tired of it, and we knew that we couldn't do anything about it. So Dr. Seltzer and I and Mel Goldman and a few others, we got together and we said, look, let's have our own little meeting. We'll come to the meeting, but one day before we'll come and we'll have our own sessions. What our residents would do, what we would do, and so forth, and we'll have a seminar. And so we did that. And we limited that to a certain number, because we knew there was no sense in inviting these mechanics to the situation. And so they came, and they became very, very popular. And it was not, it didn't interfere with the meeting at all. It was a day before. And after about 2 or 3 years, we had about 100 or 150 that attended that meeting. And after that, that's all that they would attend. After that's over, they would go, because they wouldn't want to bother with those other god darn things. And I remember I was on the on one of the committees, and of course the committees would have their meeting a day before. So a number of us would run, you see, and get out of the committee, excuse ourselves, and attend these programs. And finally, you know, they said, well, so I suggested that let's have the program one day extra, and we'll put this on officially. Those that want to come the day before, fine. Those that don't want to. And as a result, oh yes, and it was a $10 dues. And as a result of that came the outgrowth of the graduate student presentations that we give the prize, you know, I think it's $100 or something like that.
Which is terrific. Just terrific.
And this is where, this is how we decided to overcome this business of before and after. Now you go to a meeting, you never see any cases before and after, you know, with the area filling in. What's the big deal? We'll show sometime the area doesn't fill in, you see. But this is how the what you call it, the outgrowth of the graduate and undergraduate papers that are given in the in our meetings. Uh-huh. And as a matter of fact, not so long ago, one of the guys, one of the presidents or something like that, didn't want that thing in there. I said, look, you don't want it. It's going to be in anyway. So just forget it, you know. And what we decided then to do was to, and as a matter of fact, it still works as an independent organization. But I got them to within the framework of the whole thing, you see. So nobody knows, you know, that it was... That's even a separate thing. It's part and parcel of the whole thing. And in that way, we give the grad student and the undergrad student a chance to give their papers.
You give them recognition, and you also give them pride right from the beginning.
Certainly.
Motivation.
Right, exactly. We give them a chance. Because I remember... when you went to those meetings, I had the same guys over and over again give the same goddamn thing. And one day I said to Ralph Summers, I'm sick and tired of hearing you all the time. And I'm sick and tired of hearing Ostrander all the time. And I'm sick and tired of hearing Grossman all the time. God damn it, if you guys keep on talking and you don't give anybody a chance and you don't ask to have something, you're going to... pretty well get tired yourself of coming here. I says, now look, I'm not looking for any, you know, to get on the program and so forth.
I've heard that there were some lively meetings back a few years ago.
Oh, yeah, and then they decided, for example, they always wanted, oh, yes, there's another thing. We always had it in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And the reason that we had it in Chicago was, and this is for good reason, is the fact that the midwinter meeting, everybody goes there. So we had it a day or two before, you see. And so we would have our meeting, plus the fact that if we had to have a speaker, you see, we wouldn't have to pay him because he's already there, you see. And then this kept on going every goddamn year. And finally, you know, we had this problem with the weather and... Because you never know when it was going to snow. And so the planes would be canceled. And then you try to get the train, and the trains would be all loaded. As a matter of fact, when I went to Chicago, I always had two reservations, one plane and one train. So if I can't make the plane reservation, I'll have a train. And vice versa. And many times we were stuck there. So finally we decided, what the hell's the sense of us meeting in Chicago? Oh yeah, and they gave us one room, and by that time, I think the room held about 125, 150 people. We'd have 250 people. They would be hanging outside the door, you know, you couldn't hear it. So finally, and then besides which, you made reservations at the Hilton. It was the Conrad Hilton Hotel. And they never honored your reservations. Or the room wasn't ready. You wouldn't be able to get in until 6, 7 o'clock at night, you know. And it was horrible. So finally we decided, if we're going to have a meeting in the wintertime, why the hell have it in Chicago? Why not have it down in Florida? Mm-hmm. Oh, no, you know, it will be distracting. Nobody will attend. And they put on a good program and they'll attend. So, and on top of that, when you were program chairman, some of them, they would give you $50 or $150 at the most, $200 to put on the program, which included the, you know, the typing of the
unbelievable,
you know, the program and the mailing and every god darn thing else. And finally we decided we're going to have it in Florida, and there was a big stink about it. And I remember standing up there, and I tell them, I think that the trouble here is the fact that the executive committee here, or the executive board, thinks that they are anointed rather than appointed.
Great line.
And of course, that created a furor, you know, and we decided to have it at the Fontainebleau the following year. In the wintertime. Where are we going to get the money? Because after all, they weren't going to give us that. How are we going to get people to come there? And we wanted to have not only endodontists, I think we invited Bhaskar, we invited, what's his name in Chicago, the Bone and Bones.